does democracy look like?
Who should decide
your
that?
Own
the inventory of ideas
for everybody.
From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's Democracy, a short history of a big idea, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge.
Ideas matter.
I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, demanding democracy. Everyone's vote is supposed to count in America. We're all supposed to have an equal stake in the country's future. The truth is, some people really are more equal than others. Votes and influence and access to power can be bought. And where does that leave the disenfranchised? Locked out or in the streets? We talk with the kind of people who don't just sit home. They demand the equitable democracy of their dreams. From Cornel West and Tavis Smiley, to WikiLeaks activist Julian Assange, to the very first Tea Party activist.
To simply tell the truth.
An ideal.
Public conversation.
Closer to the people.
First, philosopher Cornel West is one of the most visible public intellectuals in the U.S. Tavis Smiley is, after Oprah, the best-known black media figure in the country. They co-host a weekly public radio talk show in which they frequently take on the mainstream media and the political establishment, both of which they blame for ignoring the disenfranchisement of the working poor. Steve Paulson talks with them about the state of American democracy.
Let me just start with a very basic question, and I'll just throw it to either one of you, whoever wants to pick this up first. Are African Americans still disenfranchised?
Well, I think it depends on what you mean by disenfranchised. Look at the legal level. You've got a disproportionate number of felons owing to a racist criminal justice system who are unable to vote, unable to gain access to jobs with a living wage. When you talk about right to housing, still the right to health care, even given the new health care bill under the Obama administration, there's certain fundamental rights stipulated by the UN Declaration of Rights that many Americans don't have, not just black people. And so it depends on what you mean by disenfranchised.
Mm-hmm. Tavis?
African Americans, even with a black man in the White House as president, African Americans still lag far behind in every single leading economic indicator category. There's not a single economic indicator category where African Americans do not lag far behind. And some weeks ago when that Pew research study came out, Steve, that talked about the loss of black wealth, that talked about the gap between the have-gots and the have-nots in black and white terms, it underscores yet again that not only are we disenfranchised, to your question, we are more disenfranchised now than we've been in a long time. Life for African Americans in this country right now is at depression era levels. We've been hearing this phrase, you know, this is the worst recession since the Great Depression. We've heard that across the board, the worst recession since the Great Depression. Well, for black folk, we are now at depression era levels. And the real danger is that when Obama was ushered into the White House, this conversation began amongst our colleague, Steve, that we are now living in a post-racial America.
Right.
Dr. West, I've pushed back on that consistently. America may be, indeed is, less racist to have elected Obama as president. Less racist, but not post-racial.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask about him. You've both mentioned Barack Obama here. We've got a black president. It would seem to be the epitome of the enfranchisement of African Americans.
Oh, at the legal level, there's no doubt that the election of a brilliant and charismatic president, Barack Obama, was a major breakthrough given the history of slavery and Jim Crow. The problem is he's neoconservative abroad, neoliberal at home, and therefore he's still very much a part of the structural constraints of a system that is fundamentally tilted against poor and working people. So that, again, at the legal level, he represents unprecedented achievement. That's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. That's symbolic. It results from tremendous struggle, blacks, white, red, yellow, and others. But when you look at right to jobs with a living wage, right to quality housing, right to health care, right to safety in a community without bullets flowing, you still see a disproportionate number of black folk.
And how much of that responsibility goes to the president, in this case, to Barack Obama? I mean, can you hold him accountable for this? I mean, you know, it's a huge bureaucracy that he's in charge of, huge political problems.
My dear brother, to have a Smiley, who I'm always so blessed to work with after 20-something years, he wrote a book called Accountable. So I think he's got a lot to say about the accountability of the president.
I think every president has to be held accountable. When Barack Obama, President Obama, says to Black America, as he has said many times when asked specifically why he won't address head-on problems that plague the Black community, he has said consistently, I'm the president of all of America, as if Black folks somehow aren't Americans too. Black folk need to have their issues addressed and in some cases redressed, not because they're Black, but because they're catching the most hell, because they're the ones most in pain, because they're the ones who are having lives that are becoming less and less democratized on a regular basis. So that if you were in a car accident, Steve, and they rushed you to the hospital with the head trauma, I would hope they would not start operating on your left foot. You respond to where the pain is most acute. And so in that regard, Black folk and brown folk, for that matter, and Native American brothers and sisters are not asking for respect and not asking for resources because they're Black, you know, red, yellow, or brown, but because that is where the pain is most acute. Again, back to that Pew study of weeks ago about where this country is feeling the pain the most. And so every president has to be held accountable. But I believe that we have to understand that accountability is a beautiful thing. If you ever find yourself in a relationship, personally or professionally, and your partner does not want to be held accountable, get out as quickly as you can. Accountability is a good thing in relationships, indeed for politicians. The bottom line is this, that Dr. West and I have said consistently were, and this is a Westian formulation, I can't take credit for this because he's in the room. Were he not, Steve, I would tell you this is a Tabas original. I'd be lying. But since he's here, I can't take credit for this. But this is a Westian formulation where Obama is concerned. We must respect the president. We must protect the president. We must also correct the president. We always respect the president. And when he needs to be protected against vicious, vulgar, vitriolic, racist, white supremacist, Tea Party, Donald Trump attacks, we will protect the president. He must always be respected, protected, but also corrected. This president is not Jesus. He doesn't walk on water. He makes mistakes. In many ways, he's afraid to address African-American issues, to your point, directly, because he's afraid of being accused of being tribal. And so he gives a standard response that I'm the president of all of America, and never gets around to really addressing the problems that are acutely impacting African-Americans. Although, when gays and lesbians jump up and down about don't ask, don't tell, and he should have done it sooner than he did, I'm glad he finally did it, but he responds to that particular constituency.
And you're saying he very rarely speaks specifically to African Americans.
Not rarely, never. it's not a question of rare, it's a question of never.
So you have a real problem with this, I'm the president of all America. I mean, he is, obviously.
He
but
is.
You're saying that he needs to do more than that. I mean, he needs to address specifically
but
concerns
any president who says he's the president of all America means on the ground that he responds to those who have most money, most resources, and most pressure. So when he goes to the business roundtable and says, I am the president of all America, they know exactly what he's talking about. Namely, he's going to speak to their interests before he speaks to poor people's interests because they have money, resources, and influence. And everybody knows that. So let's just get beyond the rhetoric in terms of this generic formulation of I am president of everyone. The thing I think that's most upsetting about Barack Obama, and here I think it's a philosophical point about democracy, that we know that the great contributions of the United States to world civilization have to do with the various ways in which we affirm the dignity of everyday people. It could be Emerson, it could be Whitman, it could be Muriel Rukeyser, it could be Louis Armstrong, it could be Duke Ellington, it could be Gershwin, it could be Sondheim, it could be Frank Lloyd Wright. All of these had democratic sensibilities having to do with finding the genius in everyday people, the extraordinary and ordinary people. Well, Black people have a tradition from Frederick Douglass to Martin King of a reconstruction of democracy. It's a matter of what does democracy look like in the tradition of Black people struggling against slavery, against Jim Crow, and now against Jim Crow Jr. And when you look at that tradition, King is probably the major figure. Mm-hmm. And Barack Obama mobilized King's legacy and then channeled it in neoliberal, centrist, democratic leadership, council-like ways. And that, for me, is a form of political blasphemy. Mm. Hmm. Blasphemy.
Let me move the discussion away from President Obama and ask a more general question about leadership. How much do intellectuals matter in the struggle for democracy?
Intellectuals always matter because ideas matter. I mean, part of what we're dealing with now is the triumph of right-wing ideas put forward by intellectuals, generated by think tanks, and now gaining access in the last 30 years to universities, shaping the very narrow corporate media with truncated options and limited alternatives made available to the American people, and greed is good.
So you're saying the sort of the conservative movement, the conservative revolution, it was founded by conservative intellectuals.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all the discussions we had, William Buckley and the others pushing the free markets, unregulated markets, and unfettered markets. Well, you know, they won. They convinced Larry Summers. They convinced Bill Clinton. They convinced Robert Rubin, as well as the disciples of Milton Friedman. And for a while, right, most of the economists said, what? We're all Milton Friedmanians. Well, that's an intellectual battle. Now, after 2008, when the greed is good model was shattered, right, it became clear they didn't really know what they were talking about. Oh, my God, they can't even run the system. These markets aren't self-sufficient at all. It generates fraud, indecent action, illegal action, criminal action, and so forth. So that the battle over ideas is always very, very important.
So I guess the question is why? I mean, why did the conservative intellectuals win, or at least gain the ascendancy right now? I mean, what about the intellectuals on the left?
Well, I mean, one, the liberals had marginalized the left in the 70s, and the liberal model itself began to be not just interrogated and called into question, but was unable to deliver. And the American people are in this yin-yang. If you don't go for the Democrats, then you got to go for the Republicans. So if the choice is between, well, milquetoast liberalism's not working and this mean-spirited Republicanism's got a lot of energy and conviction, and let's try it out, more and more people opted for the right-wing version. Now that's being contested. This is what we mean by decline. You know, what we witnessed in 2011 is the exhaustion, the relative exhaustion of milquetoast liberalism, mean-spirited conservatism. Where do we go? That's a deep question. That's very much what Davis and I are wrestling with in terms of the legacy of Martin King.
Yeah. And I think Steve, to build on Doc's point, if anybody can ever build on a brilliant point made by Dr. West, the democracy is in trouble so long as we think that we can live in a country where 1% of the people own and control more wealth than 90% of the people. My read of history, and I'm so glad you're doing this wonderful series on democracy, because my read of history suggests to me that there is no empire, back to Doc's framework about empire, there is no empire in the history of the world that at some point did not falter or fail. Every empire at some point fails. And I don't know if it is our arrogance, our hubris, our patriotism that has now morphed into nationalism. I don't know what it is that doesn't allow us to even consider that, like every other empire, at some point we could fail as well. This could be the beginning of the end. Now, as you well know, to say that, and I'm sure you'll get mail about this when this airs, to say that gets one labeled anti-American. So you got to be careful when, where, and how you say that, even on public radio. But at the end of the day, every empire has eventually failed. And I believe that this country one day is going to implode, or put another way, get crushed under the weight of its own poverty. If we don't figure out a way to eradicate poverty, I believe one day is ultimately going to eradicate us.
Explain what you mean. Well, how would poverty eradicate us?
Poverty will eradicate us in that you can't have this gap continue to grow between the have-gots and the have-nots. It can't happen. Dr. West mentioned earlier, at the end of Dr. King's life, King was trying to raise this very point. There is no no empire, no country in the world. What we just saw recently in Egypt and in Tunisia and still now ongoing in Libya, when you see these uprisings around the world, it happens because the poor at some point get restless. Those who are economically and politically and socially and culturally disenfranchised eventually get to a point, as I like to say, where they become like Popeye, the cartoon character. I done stoods all I can stands, and I can't stands no more. And then with Popeye, out comes the can of spinach. Well, the proverbial or the metaphorical can of spinach are the protest. People take, and y'all know something about that here in Wisconsin. You know something about that. But at some point, people get restless. People get tired. It was Fannie Lou Hamer who said, "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. Mm-hmm. At some point, people start to feel that. And that's when that energy gets channeled into a certain way. And if you don't address poverty, you don't talk about eradicating poverty, poverty may end up eradicating your empire. Because at some point, it bubbles up to a point where people can't take it anymore, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. We're running short of time here. A wrap-up question. You said earlier, the question that you two talk about, okay, what's to be done? Huge question, obviously, but for starters, where do you go?
Well, one is you've got to be like the Sankofa bird and look back at and be in contact with the best of the past in order to move forward. That's why the Whitmans and the Emersons, and that's why the Martin Kings and Fannie Lou Hamers, and that's why the Sondheims make a difference. We're talking about art. We're talking about politics. Young people need to be informed by and inspired by the best of the tradition of those who came before. And what did they do? They thought boldly. What did they do? They acted courageously and compassionately. And what did they do? They were willing to live and die for something bigger than themselves. Those are all three preconditions for any revitalization of any democracy. And if you don't have either one of them, you're going to lose your democracy and you end up with a crypto-fascist regime. And those folk who struggled in the past, they cry from their graves.
My answer simply and quickly is, and I know this may be a pipe dream, Steve, but we have to have more people who are willing to tell the truth. It's that simple for me. People who are willing to tell the truth, put another way, people who are willing, I don't mean just now media people, I mean Americans of every race, color, creed, of every political ideology, of every faith tradition. We have to have more Americans who are willing to tell the truth about the suffering of everyday people. More Americans who are willing to accept the responsibility to simply say what they see. It is impossible to look around these days in this country and to not see the fragility of our democracy. And if we just find the courage, the conviction, the commitment, the character to just tell the truth about what we see, to just say what it is that we see, that at least gets the conversation going. And I trust the American people enough, and I believe in the American people enough, that if the facts are put on the table, if someone commits himself or herself or a network or a newspaper, not to cover in the horse race, not to cast in the story of framing it in terms of winners and losers, but to simply tell the truth. Tell the American people the truth, and we can figure this out. But this game of winning versus losing, that's what's going to kill us.
Cornel West and Tavis Smiley are the hosts of Public Radio's weekly talk program, Smiley and West. Steve Paulson spoke with them.
Priority.
Most Deaf from Raise Hope for Congo.
Bay. Top priority. Peace before everything. God before anything. Love before anything. Real before everything. Home before any place. Shoot before anything. Style and stay radiate. Love, power, slay the hate. Truth killer, fakey face. Bayer say it to they face. Ain't afraid of major straight. Grace set the table straight. Flow greatest like the greatest lakes. Gates on great estates, quiet water, major waves. Steer the course, make a way, and come ashore on a greater day. Homegrown from the greatest grain, full flavor in the native strain. Now put that on your brainy brain. Full exposure to faith and slang, minimum wage and major gangs. Y'all seen Dante the Bay, day to night and day to day. They came to play, we came to stay. Get out the way. B.I.G. Sunspot Heat Rocks, Brooklyn Finest Preservation of B-Box. Friend of Folk Poison of Detox. When we rock, the people are respond priority. Peace before anything, God before everything. Love before anything, real before everything. Home before any place, shoot before anything. Style and stay radiate. Love, power, slay the hate, priority.
You'll find an extended version of their interview on our website at ttbook.org, now featuring 20 years of interviews available to stream, download, and share. Coming up, a candid interview with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Demanding Democracy, is part of our special series, Democracy, A Short History of a Big Idea, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
Vice President Joe Biden has called him a high-tech terrorist. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says his work tears at the fabric of responsible governments. His supporters include the hacker group Anonymous, which brought down the websites of Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal in his name. We're talking about Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, and one of the most controversial figures of our time. Whether you agree with him or not, Assange's work grows out of a strong commitment to using information technology to foster democracy. Anne Strainchamps reached Assange in England, where he's under house arrest. He spoke with her outdoors from a cell phone on a windy day.
There's a phrase you've used a number of times. You see censorship as opportunity. In what way is censorship an opportunity?
Well, censorship requires work. It is investment for governments and other organizations to censor material that has already gone out to the public or to try and prevent it getting out to the public in the first place. And people don't tend to expend money without cause. So censorship is a signal that an organization or a government is fearful about the reform effects of an information release.
So it's a kind of marker, like a sign of disease.
Yeah, exactly. I would say on the one hand, it's a marker of disease. That is, there's things that the government is trying to cover up. On the other hand, it's a marker of the health of a political system in that the government is afraid of what people think. We should be careful about saying that the situation of a relative lack of traditional legal censorship is as a result of governments having nothing to conceal. Rather, in my experience, it's as a result of the strongest patronage systems within the country not being scared of what the public thinks. In these modern Western countries, the basic relationships between powerful groups is fiscal. So it's done in shareholdings or contracts between individuals and companies or bank holdings or multi-layered fiscal instruments. And when there's a change in political mood in a country as a result of exposure, it doesn't change the figures on a contract. It doesn't change the contents of the bank account. And so people in power have little to fear by press exposure.
I'm curious, what about democracy in America? I mean, is there information out there that, if made public, would have the potential to transform the balance of power in this country?
I think it's quite difficult. I've wondered what that information would be and look like. When we released, we're still in the process of releasing Cablegate, but when we entered into the Cablegate publication phase, we saw a reaction by Washington and its friends that was cartoonish, that was produced a sort of McCarthyist fervor for around 2 months, was very startling and unusual, but reminded everyone of what was happening under the Soviet. And so that's an example where information at that level and at such quantity, they can produce significant reform effects and produce a back reaction by people in power. What other sort of information would be like that, given the extraordinary fiscalization in the United States? Perhaps all emails of the New York Times going back 10 years. Maybe that would produce similar understanding of the interplays between these big power and patronage groups in the U.S. Perhaps the same for the finance industry, although within finance, matters tend to be quite complicated. Maybe all the emails of the U.S. Congress, if you had them all going back a few years, perhaps that would produce a similar level of reaction. But I think it's because of the strong fiscalization, which results in a depoliticization of the basic power structures in the country, it is going to take something at that level. Of course, the National Security Agency intercepts SMS and telephone traffic coming in and out of the United States. A number had suggested domestically in places in the United States as well. If that material was released, we might see a desire to reform the intelligence sector.
So is that your wish list, in a sense?
Well, I have a long wish list. I think that for the United States, that wouldn't be a bad start.
Julian Assange is the founder of WikiLeaks. And Strange Champ spoke with him while he was under house arrest in England. The only way he could do the interview was by cell phone, outside on a windy day. You can hear the extended version on our website at ttbook.org, now featuring 20 years of interviews available to stream, download, and share. You're listening to the unofficial anthem of the Arab Spring by Hamara Ben Amour, the Tunisian rapper known as El General. The song is called Raid Le Bled. Translated, the lyrics begin, Mr. President, your people are dying. People are eating rubbish. Look at what is happening. Misery's everywhere, Mr. President. I talk with no fear. El General was detained shortly after the song was released. 8 days later, Tunisian President Ben Ali fled his country after 23 years of authoritarian rule. For to the best of our knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Demanding Democracy, is part of our special series, Democracy, A Short History of a Big Idea, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. The leaders of the civil rights movement not only demanded equal rights for black America, they expected it. One of those leaders was named Bayard Rustin. Historian John DeMillo is the author of the book called Lost Prophet, The Life and Times of Bayard Rustin. DeMillo says Rustin was a pivotal figure in the civil rights movement, but he's been virtually erased by history.
He's incredibly important in terms of the movements for peace and social justice in post-World War II America. More than anybody else, he's the one who brings Gandhi and Gandhian ideas to the black civil rights struggle, things that we normally associate with Martin Luther King. He mentors Martin Luther King. But yet, whereas Martin Luther King is a name that every person alive in the United States knows, no one knows who Bayard Rustin is except hardcore pacifists and aficionados of the civil rights movement. And the reason for that is that Rustin had to figure out how to be an agitator for justice and work effectively without people noticing him because he was a gay man living in an era when the constraints on that were so intense.
To make things unworkable. The only weapon we have is our bodies, and we need to tuck them in places so wheels don't turn.
Rustin grew up in southeastern Pennsylvania in really Quaker country, and his grandmother, who was the key person in his life, had worked in Quaker households, and so Quakerism was part of his environment. And by the time he was in his mid-20s, he actually began going to Quaker meetings very regularly. It suffused the way he looked at the world. There is a personal pacifism as well as a political pacifism that shaped his outlook. And when World War II came along, you know, most other Americans thought of it as a war that was eminently justified, and Bayard Rustin chose to go to jail rather than in any way cooperate with the military.
I'm a Quaker, and as everyone knows, Quakers for 300 years have, on conscientious grounds, been against participating in war.
Hear the
Rustin often said that King was one of the most impressive figures he had ever met, that King had a power that Byard had rarely encountered in another human. At the same time, it was a charismatic power that lacked the skills of community organizing, of knowing how to build a movement, how to create an organization, how to have a strategy of change as opposed to simply saying, march, people. And Rustin was the one who taught him about strategy and about organization and about movement building, and who acted as his point man in doing those sorts of things. And that's what Rustin brought to King when Rustin was in his mid-40s and King was still a very young minister in his mid-20s.
There are three ways to deal with injustice. One is to accept it slavishly, or one can resist it with arms, or one can use nonviolence. The man who believes in nonviolence is prepared to be harmed, to be crushed, but he will never crush others.
For a number of years, King just turned to Rustin. He would say, write me this article and I'll sign it, or yes, I'll meet with these people who can fundraise, or yes, this, yes, that, yes, the other thing. And for years, he didn't make an important decision without consulting Rustin, and Rustin made himself available. But Rustin always used to say that while King was very good at confronting, quote, the enemy, the segregationist, he was not very good at confronting turmoil within the ranks of the civil rights movement. So that when controversy would surround Rustin, when people would bring up at times his either radical background or his gayness, Martin Luther King would cave. And there was this one critical moment in 1960 where Adam Clayton Powell, who was a congressman from Harlem, the most prominent African American in national politics in the Democratic Party, was getting a little teed off, really, at Rustin's effort to exert influence, and especially in relationship to the Democratic Party. And Powell lets King know that if he doesn't get rid of Rustin as his assistant, Powell is going to start spreading rumors that King and Rustin are sexually involved. Well, King caved in, and here they had this really close relationship for like 5 years and then barely spoke to each other for another 2 years or 2.5 years.
I must walk my lonesome valley. I got to walk it for myself. Nobody else can walk it for me. I got to walk it for myself.
Strom Thurmond, who was, you know, he had run as a segregationist for president in 1948. In 1963, he is prepared to do anything to discredit the civil rights movement. And the March on Washington was the big upcoming event. He tried to discredit it by saying, oh, it's a bunch of communists who are doing it, and people yawned. And he then moved on to isolating Rustin, who at that point was known as really Mr. March on Washington. And he gets up on the Senate floor and reads into the congressional record Rustin's arrest record, reads from newspaper clippings in the Los Angeles papers from the 1950s about Rustin getting arrested.
The senator is not interested in me if I were a murderer, a thief, a liar, or a pervert. The senator is interested in attacking me because he is interested in destroying the movement. He will not get away with this.
We're marching on to freedom land. We're marching on to freedom land.
It becomes actually a turning point in Rustin's public career because the march was only like maybe 2 weeks away at that point, and it was too big an event. And so the civil rights establishment has to, for the first time, publicly defend Rustin because the alternative is to cave into Strom Thurmond, arch enemy of the community and the movement. And so it's the point at which the gay card is finally trumped in Rustin's life. It's now so public, and the movement has said, we don't care.
I now bring to you the executive director of the March on Washington, the man who organized this whole thing, Mr. Bayard Rustin.
Ladies and gentlemen, the first demand is that we have effective civil rights legislation, no compromise, no filibuster, and that it includes public accommodations, decent housing, integrated education, FAPC, and the right to vote. What do you say?
The thing to me that's so amazing about his life is that he comes from nowhere. You know, he's the illegitimate son of a teenage mother in a small provincial town, right? And he travels the globe. He organizes demonstrations on four continents. He moves among people who really do make history. Rustin is not a tragic figure. He rises from the ashes again and again. And especially if you look at pictures of him late in life, this guy was having a lot of fun. I mean, he had a good life. What is tragic for us as a nation, really, or as a people, is that the talents of this man could not be fully utilized in the way that they could have the biggest impact on history. The tragedy is the homophobia and the racism. But Rustin, you have to say, I mean, the guy never gave up.
John DeMillo is the author of the book called Lost Prophet, The Life and Times of Bayard Rustin. Rustin remained committed to racial equality and world peace until his death in 1987.
From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state, and every we will be able to speed up that day when all children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Kelly Carinder is a Seattle area blogger, considered by many to be the very first Tea Party activist. She's a young math teacher with enough body piercings to look more like an Obama supporter than a right-wing activist. But in 2009, she organized one of the first protests against the Democratic stimulus package. Today, she writes a popular blog under the name Liberty Bell. She tells Steve Paulson what those first protests were like.
I mean, they were amazing because there's so many of us across the nation that just never spoke out, never protested, sort of thought that our civic duty revolved around elections rather than in between elections, keeping politicians accountable and trying to influence policy. And so these first few protests were these amazing moments of finding like-minded people, especially if you're in a place like I am, that is very not known for its, it's not very known for its conservative leanings.
You're in Seattle.
Right. And Seattle is a very, very liberal town. So finding other people who were like-minded was this great moment, and knowing that you're not alone and that there are other people who do think like you. So that was fantastic. So that's how they used to be. And I would say they've changed a lot because people no longer feel completely out of the loop. I mean, believe me, we still feel like there are so many things that are still wrong, and there's so many politicians on the left and the right that have no regard for the citizenry. But we do feel like we've got a toe, a little foot in the door.
Is this all just about economics? Is it about trying to limit government spending?
Yeah. So I affiliate with Tea Party Patriots. There's a few different umbrella groups. The one I affiliate with and work for is Tea Party Patriots. And we have three guiding principles: fiscal responsibility, constitutionally limited government, and free markets. So it very much is an economic movement.
So a lot of the traditional causes that Republicans rally around, especially the social issues like protesting the right to an abortion or gay marriage, those are not important issues to you.
No, because first of all, there's so many other groups that deal with social issues on either side of the issue. They're very well established. They're well funded. So we basically say, look, if you want to get involved in something like abortion, there's tons of groups out there on either side that you can get involved with. There wasn't really a movement, though, or a group that really dealt with these economic issues from our point of view. And those issues are so divisive that, you know, at any given Tea Party meeting, you'll have two people sitting next to each other that, you know, one is very pro-choice and one is very pro-life. And then you'll have two people working together on a Tea Party protest, who supports gay marriage and one who is vehemently against it. So these issues, these economic issues, unite people in such a phenomenal way that, and like I said, there's other groups that deal with those other issues. You can't be everything to everyone. You know, you have to stay focused. And if we really want to affect policy and legislation on these economic issues, then we have to be focused on them.
So let's just play this out for a little bit. You're saying there's way too much government intervention in our lives. Too much money is being spent by the government. Very specifically, what should the government not be spending money on that it is now?
Lots of stuff. Well, let's take a look at some of the various departments. There's, you know, the Department of Agriculture. I remember I was in D.C. about a year ago, and I was driving by. I was in a cab, and I was driving by all of these buildings, building after building after building after building, with rows of cubicles and floors of cubicles. And I just thought, what do all those people do? And one of them was the Department of Agriculture. I think we need to be very judicious in these departments. Department of Education. Like, what does the Department of Education do? I understand that you know, we spend money on education, but it doesn't, you know, I'm not against public education, but what does the Department of Education actually do? So I would first, you know, I would want to take a look at the various departments, commissions, agencies, boards. I know the GAO put out a study. There's over $200 billion of redundancies across these various boards and commissions and agencies and things like that. So that sort of thing I'd like to stop spending money on.
Well, just to take this as an example, presumably the U.S. Education Department studies educational policy. It studies what makes for effective teaching and ineffective teaching. It works on standardized tests. The mission is to try to have some overall standards for what makes good schooling around the country. You're saying those are not important issues?
Well, I'm saying that those issues could also partially be done at the state level. It's not the federal government's job to run education, and different states need different things. I also think if you look at the size of the Department of Education, if you're really just going to have one little commission that sort of studies what's effective education, what's not, and that sort of thing, I don't think you need an entire department. So maybe we don't get rid of the Department of Education. Maybe we scale it down to the size that it really should be, which would save us a lot of money. And the same thing for the Department of Agriculture, you know, and these various departments that maybe we need a very small agency that studies some things. It just seems, you know, our regulatory agencies are huge because they have to be to keep up with all of these onerous rules and regulations. I would also go very far in saying that one of the projects we're working on right now is the healthcare compact, and that is an effort to completely remove healthcare from the federal government and bring it back to the states. The federal government would still be spending money, but it would basically be completely block granted to the states with no strings attached. A lot of people, when they talk about block grants, there's still strings attached. We're talking about completely free to spend the money on healthcare the way that the state wants to. So Vermont, for instance, could become a single payer state if they wanted to. And a state like Texas could try out free market reforms.
So whenever possible, you would like to bring the control of all kinds of governmental decisions to the state level, take it out of federal hands.
Yeah. And the reason is because, you know, for me, it takes me a little just over an hour to get to my state capital. There and back is less than a tank of gas for me. I can visit my legislators. I can go to the governor's office. You know, I can go to hearings. I can actually testify at a hearing on a piece of legislation. For me in Seattle to get to D.C., say, to testify, which I'm sure I wouldn't even be able to testify, you know, would be a day there, a day back in travel, hundreds of dollars. My U.S. representatives represent way more, you know, hundreds of thousands of more people than my state rep represents. So I have a bigger voice. We all have a much bigger voice the smaller, the closer the decision making gets to the people. So what we want is to look at every single policy choice and ask the question, who decides? Who should decide that question? If it's education or healthcare, you know, or agriculture or environmental or whatever it is, at what level should that decision be made? And I think in every case, where it's possible, bring it as close to the people as possible. Again, how much easier is it for us to go to a school board meeting and have an effect on the school policy there than it is to go to D.C. and to try to talk to somebody at Department of Education who's probably not going to care who you are at all? And make sure that most of the decisions that are being made by elected people so that we can hold them accountable. Because the bigger government gets, especially at the federal level, the more the decisions are made by bureaucrats that have no accountability to the people at all. So closer to the people and made by folks who are elected rather than appointed or hired.
Now, there have been a lot of political movements over the course of history in America, and a number of them burn out after a few years, maybe after sort of the initial sort of popular outrage has worn off. What's your sense of the future of the Tea Party?
Well, I'm an optimist, first of all. But second, you know, I've heard a lot of people say, well, I haven't seen that many people at protests lately. I'm worried. What's going on? And I travel the country a lot, and I meet with local groups a lot. You're not seeing a lot of the Tea Party out in the streets because they're working. They're going to these meetings. Some of them are running for local offices. They at least have a monthly group meeting, if not weekly. They're really involved in their local communities. So there obviously is always a chance that people are going to burn out. And I do think that after the election, people put so much into building up to the election that there are some people I know that have said, look, I'm going to take the next few months off, then I'll get back involved maybe, you know, summertime 2011. So there are some people that, you know, you do get burnt out. It's basically a volunteer-based movement, so you really run the risk of burnout with volunteers. But I've never met so many people that are so committed to an ideal. And I think it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing to see people turn away from being committed to a person or a politician, because I think on both sides of the aisle, we've had that for way too long. And then because we're committed to that person or that politician, we look the other way when they make mistakes and when they do not keep their promises or when they're corrupt. And I think to be committed rather than to a person, to an ideal, you can hold those people accountable, and you have it's such a bigger view than a person. So I think because of that, we have a very good chance of sustaining for quite a long time.
Do you think the Republican Party has more or less taken on Tea Party values, or do you still see a disjunction between the Republican establishment and the Tea Party movement?
I think there is still a gap between not only the Republican establishment, and it's going to sound weird, but the Democrat establishment too. I mean, obviously the Democrats have a big problem with the Tea Party ideals. But what I'm trying to say is I think there is this establishment of people in both parties who don't want to rock the boat. You know, Nancy Pelosi said something about how she wished elections didn't matter so much, meaning what she was saying was she wished that the two parties could be closer again instead of Republicans being off, you know, being pulled off into this Tea Party path, that if they were just closer together, it would be easier to govern. And, you know, and so I think there's actually a lot of Republicans at the top that think like that as well. It's scary to take a stand for something and have the press come after you. And, you know, you have to know your stuff. You have to be able to defend your beliefs and defend them rationally. And so there's definitely still a gap. A lot of us are starting to feel like, you know, this isn't a Democrat versus Republican fight anymore. We feel like it's the people versus a ruling elite who think that they know better than us. And some of them are Democrats, some of them are Republicans, but they think they know how to run our lives better than we do. And that's what we're fighting against.
Kelly Carinder is a Seattle area blogger considered by many to be the very first Tea Party activist. Steve Paulson spoke with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour is called Demanding Democracy. It's part of our special series, Democracy, A Short History of a Big Idea, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our series was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Ann Strainchamps, and Doug Gordon. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions wrote the theme music. For more information about anything you heard in this hour, visit our website at ttbook.org, now featuring 20 years of interviews available to stream, download, and share. And the last word goes to Chilean writer Isabel Allende. On September 11th, 1973, her uncle Salvador Allende, the president-elect of Chile, was assassinated. 13 years later, another September 11th changed the world again, which she calls a terrible irony.
It's one of those karmic coincidences. In both cases, it was a terrorist attack. In both cases, it was on a Tuesday, September 11th, almost at the same time of the day. And one of them was sponsored by the United States. The other one happened in the United States. It is a chilling coincidence, I think. And in my case, in the first September 11th, I lost a country. On the second September 11th, I think I gained a country because for the first time, I felt that I belonged in the United States. I could relate to what people in the streets were feeling, that feeling of fear, of unsafety, of vulnerability, the feeling that we can't control what's going on.
How do you feel about American democracy now?
I used to be very proud of it. Not anymore. It disturbs me because I see signs that I have seen before. I see the slow chipping off the individual rights, the right to dissent, the right to oppose to whatever the government is doing. And that bothers me a lot. I think that's the beginning of something very serious.
PRI, Public Radio International.